The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we've got another episode of Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on how democracy works. We try to answer your civics-related questions submitted through our listener line, email, Twitter, and our website, which is how we got today's question.
This is Kevin Nibel from Boise, Idaho, and I have a question about how does the budget office score a proposed bill's costs and benefits when so much can be utterly unknown at the time and future policy changes?
When Republicans first submitted their proposed alternative to the Affordable Care Act, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle anxiously awaited the release of the Congressional Budget Office's analysis, or score, for the bill. That bill failed to pass, but there will be others. So we are digging into what the CBO does and how it projects a proposed bill's costs when the variables are so complicated and unpredictable. Alice Rivlin is here to help. She was founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, a position she held from 1975 to 1983. She's now senior fellow in economic studies and the Center for Health Policy at the Brookings Institution. And Alice, thank you for making time for a Civics 101 class.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What is the origin of the Congressional Budget Office?
It goes back to the early 70s and the Nixon administration. At that time, most of the budget calculations were done by the executive branch. The numbers, the projections, costing of new proposals, and things like that came out of the executive branch. But in the early 70s, there was a lot of conflict between the president and the Congress, as there often is. But President Nixon did something that the Congress reacted very negatively to. He refused to spend some of the money that they had appropriated. And since Congress controls appropriations, that was something they were quite furious about. So they did what they had should have done a long time earlier. They got themselves together to have a better budget process on Capitol Hill, a better way of making decisions about the national budget, and a source of numbers and analysis that worked for them. They created a Congressional Budget Office, and I was lucky enough to be the first director.
So this was through the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974. As the first director, you shaped the office in those first years. Now, what was your goal? What were you trying to do?
Well, my goal was to fulfill the congressional expectations, which were that they should have a very well-qualified staff of people working for them to help them evaluate budget issues. That meant that we had to recruit people who could do this from wherever we could find them and set up this office, which was a nonpartisan office. We worked for both Republicans and Democrats, and we worked for both sides of Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives and the Senate. So it was nonpartisan, impartial, good advice, we thought.
So an agent for Congress, not the executive branch. No formal power, never taking an explicit position. True?
That was actually a decision that I made that I think worked out well. We could have given the Congress advice on what they ought to do. The law was vague on this. But I decided that was a bad idea. If we were going to be credible to both parties and all factions, we needed to give them options, give them the best information we could about what those alternative policies would cost and what they would do, but not take a position.
Who appoints the director of the office?
Well, it's a little complicated, but it is essentially the budget, the two budget committees. The formal appointment is by the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, who's the senior senator normally, and on the advice of the budget committee. So the budget committees really decide.
So what is the background of these professionals that you wanted to assemble and that still work for the CBO?
Well, of course, it isn't the same people because most of the people I appointed have retired, but they're the same kind of people. They are economists, mostly accountants, and a few lawyers. But they are basically people who are experienced with budget analysis and estimating the costs of public policies, costs and effects.
I'm speaking with Alice Rivlin, founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, about why the office was created and how it works. This is, to me, what seems so difficult, the hardest math problem in the world, as far as I can see it. And we don't really want to dig into the math, but about that process. How does the CBO staff work to estimate the cost of a particular bill, projecting year by year, with so many different factors that could contribute to that cost?
Well, it isn't easy. They do the best they can. And in general, they assemble information about what's happened in the past with the same program, if it's being changed, or with similar programs, if there hasn't been anything like this before. They look at information from the states, which might have had a similar program. But they really have to make their best judgment under great uncertainty. For example, if you're starting a new health program, you have to guess how many people will take advantage of it what it will cost to provide those services.
And sometimes they have to do it really quickly, it looks like.
Yes, they do have to do it really quickly when they're in the mode of having a piece of legislation before them and the Congress is saying, fast, what will this cost and how many people will it cover or how many people will lose coverage if we change it in this way? So they have to react very quickly. Often they have more time to do a more careful long-range analysis. They do other kinds of reports. But when there's a bill before them, they have to work fast.
Do you recall times that bills lived or died based on the CBO score?
Yes, that's quite normal. And indeed, in crafting a piece of legislation, the Congress or the administration takes into account what the CBO is likely to say. And that's because resources are very constrained. We don't have enough coming in revenues from taxes to pay for all the things that people want to do. We've run up a very big debt, and so the Congress has made rules about keeping the spending under control and not allowing big changes that will require a lot more debt. So that makes the people who are crafting legislation very conscious of what will this piece of legislation do to the deficit and the long-run debt. How will it change things for the better or for the worse?
I use that word CBO score, which is something that a lot of people say on Capitol Hill. Is it actually a score, you know, a sort of viability 1 to 10, 1 to 100?
No, it is a set of estimates of cost and also effects. For example, in the recent health bill, the CBO was asked, what will the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act cost? How much will it change the deficit and the long-run debt? And how many people who currently have insurance coverage will lose their coverage? So that set of estimates are loosely called the score.
Well, as you well know, the Trump spokesman Sean Spicer criticized those projections on the Republican plan to replace the ACA. He said the CBO was way, way off in every aspect of how they scored and projected Obamacare. Now, you yourself, in 1981, President Reagan called your numbers phony because they differed from the optimistic projections of his office and management and budget. So looking back at all these unknowns, did the CBO ever get it completely wrong?
Well, I think a better question is, did they ever get it completely right? Nobody ever gets these estimates exactly right because, as you've indicated, they're very complicated and they involve a lot of moving parts. Well, in the case of the Affordable Care Act, later called Obamacare, the CBO did underestimate the cost of that. They thought it would cost more because they thought more people would gain coverage than actually did. So they were wrong about that for understandable reasons. And they, as the Act came into effect, they, of course, used the information that was coming from the actual program and made more accurate estimates.
Alice, you know, data analysts and economists, statisticians are not always the best people at explaining things. Was there anybody in place in your office that worked with you to help, I don't know, translate these kind of numbers and analysis into English?
Yes, that was very important to me. I thought the kinds of people we were hiring, many of whom had PhDs in economics, and economists are not awfully good at explaining things, I thought it was really important that we write in plain English. And we actually hired a writing coach to help us because I thought this was so important to make the reports clear to the audience, which was first and foremost the Congress, but then also the press and the public. And I think we did quite a good job about that.
Well, Alice, thank you so much for explaining the CBO in English to us today. Really appreciate your time.
I enjoyed it.
Alice Rivlin, she's the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. She's now senior fellow in economic studies and the Center for Health Policy at the Brookings Institution.
This is Ben Winters with the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
And I'm Virginia Prescott. I admit I find Ben Winters a little incomprehensible. Not his output, which is consistently great, but his wild imagination and range. He's a teacher, a playwright, an Edgar Award and Philip K. Dick Award-winning novelist. He's written children's books, a terrific detective series, and landed a New York Times bestseller with a Jane Austen meets the Kraken mashup called Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters. He's also a journalist and a dad. His most recent novel, Underground Airlines, imagines an alternative American history and present. The Civil War has never happened, and slavery is legal in four southern states. Underground Airlines is an ingenious work of speculative fiction because at times it seems so chillingly plausible. The best-selling book landed on several top 10 lists in 2016, from Fresh Air contributor Maureen Corrigan to the BBC. We caught up with Ben Winters at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire, before interviewing him and Underground Railroad author Colson Whitehead, and asked, which is harder for him?
Oh, finishing. Oh, yeah. Totally finishing. Starting is easy. Everybody loves to start. I could start all day long. Finishing is hard. And actually, it isn't even finishing. It's the middle. The middle is the hardest part. You often have an idea or a strong feel for the ending long before you know how you're going to get from the beginning to the ending.
So how much plotting or planning do you do beforehand? Do you kind of like outline, set things all together before you start writing?
I do not enough, probably, and it goes back and forth. So I'll write a bunch with whatever the sort of first burst of energy or the sort of engine of the idea is, get as far as that'll take me, and then I do some sort of ragged outline, which I then kind of, as I proceed in the book, I go back and forth between the text and the outline, constantly revising both, making a bigger and bigger mess until at some point I have to clean it up, and that's called the book.
But you do a whole world building for this one. You know, everything from, you know, like Norman Rockwell paintings are different. James Brown is different. What is that process like for you? How do you begin that?
Well, Underground Airlines was a special case because it is, as you say, it's a version of America. So there are a lot of familiar elements that are transformed by the very dark premise, by the kind of heightened idea that there is still slavery. So everything is transformed by that. But the thing is, once I had a kind of a general idea, the big idea, the smaller things, the details, they kind of flow downward from that. And then it's also a matter of just making sure that everything that you do include, all those details are driven by the story, that you're not just embellishing and putting in stuff because you think it's cool or interesting or you think it would be kind of show-offy or just like unnecessary filigrees, that everything that appears, every detail is in service to the story.
With this idea of this kind of mess that becomes a book, how do you know when you're done?
Well, at a certain point, you're obligated to turn it in by contract. I mean, I think that's a very glib answer, but I actually think it's very helpful to have deadlines, even if they're artificial deadlines that you give yourself, because otherwise it's in the nature of fiction that you could work on it forever. So I do think, though, that at a certain point as an artist, you learn to recognize when you have taken something and made it more or less what you imagine it was going to be. Or at least, like, I think there's this, I can't remember who said it, but there's this differential between your taste, you know, which is like your ideal of what the work should be, and then your ability, and you're just constantly trying to move that up that bar graph or whatever it is from point A to point B. And at a certain point you go, okay, this is pretty much it. It's not going to get a lot better than this. And then if I keep working on this, it's going to start to go down the other side of the mountain and get to be back toward being a mess.
Where do you write? Describe your sort of desk space.
Well, ideally, I work on a very clean desk, sort of looking out a window, but I feel like somehow my desk always ends up getting really messy, and then my kids come home, so I have to go work at a coffee shop, or I work at the library, or sometimes I work in the backyard. I actually think it's an important skill as a writer to be able to work pretty much anywhere, because I think that if you start getting into this kind of fetish of space, like, oh, it has to be like this, it has to work from this time to this time, I have to have this, you know, I have to have coffee, whatever, then you're looking for reasons to not get the work done, as opposed to just trying to get to a place where whenever I can, whenever there's a moment where I can work, wherever I am, if I have my computer or a notebook, I can just start working. So I sort of, that's what I aspire to for the most part.
But do you have rituals? Do you have a schedule? Like, I'm going to write from this time to this time every day?
I try to, yeah. And in fact, when I really get into a book, I end up being very specific with myself. So I'll say tomorrow I'm going to work from 9 until 9:45 on chapter 7, and then I'm going to work from 9:45 to 10:30 on tracing out this character's journey. I'm going to work on the dialogue, but, you know, and then I'm going to make a phone call. I try to do a lot of research. So I actually, when I'm really deep into a book, I do a lot of very specific scheduling, because I find it's really valuable to have some kind of a roadmap for the day of work. Because with writing, if you just say, oh, I'm going to work tomorrow, I'm going to write for 3 hours. And you sit down, it's like, well, that's a long time. You're just looking at a blank page. It feels very overwhelming and kind of impossible. So I try to divide it into tasks, just like you would in any job. You know, if you're a radio producer or you're a lawyer, you don't just say, well, tomorrow I'm going to radio produce all day, or I'm going to go practice the law. Like, you have your things you're going to do. You check off, you march through your tasks. So for me, it's that balance of the kind of craftsmanship or logistical energy of, like, this is the things I'm going to do, balanced with the creative energy of just now I'm just going to write, you know?
What is the most common mistake you think that new writers make?
They don't read enough. I mean, I think pretty much the most of what you learn, the necessary skills you learn as a writer, come from reading. And I think that as much as you can learn from a good teacher or from a good craft book, so much of what you need to do is just read and read and read. And sort of you identify not only the craft secrets. Oh, how did she create this bit of suspense? How did she arc out? You know, oh, I see what the kind of structure that she put in place here. But you also, you learn what your taste is. You if you read a lot of different kind of work, you understand the kind of work that you want to do. I think, like, the best lessons I've gotten as a writer from, like, Patricia Highsmith, John le Carré, Ralph Ellison. It's by just sort of immersing yourself in really great writers that you go, oh, okay, I understand what kind of writer I want to be, and hopefully a sense of how am I going to be a writer.
Is there a book or a work that made you think, I want to be a writer, or, you know, changed your life?
I think there's probably been a bunch over the years. The first I remember is probably The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster, which I definitely read when I was 10 or 11, probably, where I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is great. But then, you know, in college, I got really into Charles Dickens. I took a class on Dickens. I was like, this stuff is not only kind of dense and literary, but also hilarious. You know, I was like, oh, this is so much fun. And then actually, when I got that gig to write Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, which was my first published novel, weirdly, I had to really engage with the original novel, this Jane Austen novel, Sense and Sensibility, and it was, like, mind-blowing how beautiful it was, and also how clever it was, and how well-constructed. And then finally, most recently, I got really into John le Carré, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Spy Who Came In From the Cold, all that stuff, which I think was most recently really revolutionary to me in terms of how you craft a thriller or a suspense novel and how you do it with just complexity, 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 not spoon-feeding anything.
What's on your nightstand now?
Well, I have a friend named Anton Piatigorsky who has a novel that's about to come out called Altunsi, which is about the Supreme Court, and it's very, very clever and good. So I'm about halfway through that. I recently read a book called IQ by an author named Joe Edie. And I'm about to read a book called Cartel by Don Winslow, who's an author that I've been meaning to read for a year now and have not had a chance yet. So I'm very excited to start Cartel.
Do you have a desert island book?
I love the book The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith. Every time I read it, I learn something else about writing and about suspense. And she was just a fascinating figure. And I find that book sort of infinitely delightful.
Ben Winters, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ben Winters, author of the New York Times bestseller Underground Airlines and an unbelievable range of other books, including the Last Policeman trilogy of existential detective novels, which is set in Concord, New Hampshire, our home and where our conversation was recorded. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop is a production of NHPR. This episode was produced by Sarah Plourd with help from Maureen McMurray.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and I'm in a food rut. I really do love to cook, and I love the idea of eating locally sourced food. But by mud season, my motivation and taste for squash and potatoes grows stale. So I asked Keith Saracen to help jolt me out of my habitual dishes. He's chef and founder of The Farmer's Table. He and his crew do on-site farm-to-table dinners using locally produced foods. To be sure, cooking local is easier in the spring, summer, and fall when local farms are bumping. But considering that we just got a foot of snow last week, what does he cook in the winter?
So, how adventurous do we want to go? We
can go as adventurous as possible. I met up with Keith at the Winter Farmers Market at the Mark Fisk School in Salem on a chilly Sunday morning. The challenge? Buy local foods and put together a meal so delicious that we, thinking I'd bring back something to share with my colleagues, would forget for a moment the dingy gray piles of slush outside. What's your strategy, Keith, going into a place like this? Like, what are you looking for?
The first thing I look for is the quality of what we can get for vegetables right now. Mm-hmm. There's still some vegetables from the root houses and stuff like that, so I go vegetable first.
Okay. That strategy is a kind of full-body experience for Keith, seeing and smelling the produce. And warning, this is an NPR food segment, so you are going to hear some...
Mm. Oh, smell fantastic.
Mmm.
Nice, right?
Oh, I see.
And watermelon
beautiful
rashes.
Watermelon rashes.
Yeah. Mm.
There's also a lot of touching.
First thing I want to feel for is a firm texture.
This one looks a little wrinkly.
Yeah, you can push on it, and mm-hmm. you see how it kind of springs back a bit.
Firmer. And even listening, which for him means going to the market without an agenda.
We kind of just go and let the ingredient say what it wants to be, which is weird and spiritual, but it makes sense.
Here's the ingredient.
Yeah, I'm the ingredient whisperer.
I gotta say, come end of winter, early spring, vegetables are not really speaking to me. I do buy foreign fruit and meat and fish at the supermarket. And if I'm in town, I do walk to my winter's farmers markets and pick up greens and onions, but mostly clomp past the baskets of turnips and rutabaga and celerac in my heavy boots to grab a loaf of my favorite bread before it sells out. Toast is my true winter staple, which is a little embarrassing to admit to Keith.
Those onions
Have
look fantastic.
Have I ever cooked a rutabaga in my life? No.
Really?
No.
We might just put you in an apron then, and then you can check that off the bucket list.
It's not on my bucket list.
Well.
Or Celerac, for that matter.
That's another one I wonder about, Celerac.
Celerac's awesome.
What do you do with it?
A lot of different things. You can make a slaw out of it, puree.
Celerac, for the record, is the root of the celery plant. It's a tuber, and you can cook it like a potato.
It's one of those things that people go, I don't know what to do with that, and they then avoid it as a result of it.
Keith, I soon see, is more than an ingredient whisperer. He's a local produce booster. He refers to sunchokes as the New England truffle and looks most kindly upon imperfect vegetables, the parsnip with teeny bug trails or the carrot gnarled by New England's rocky soil.
When you see tomatoes in the summer and stuff like that, a lot of people will go for that perfect tomato. If I'm doing sauces, that's the last thing I want. I want those ugly fruits. The ugly fruits and vegetables have such a purpose, and that's the stuff that when you walk into a grocery store, you don't see that anymore, right? Everything's perfect and pristine. But nature is cruel, and nature has some backbone to it. And so what we want to do is we want to say, okay, what are we doing with the product, and how can we help the farmer? That's where it starts.
We go dish by dish, inspired by what's there. Keith's instinct for rescuing misfit vegetables steers us towards what the farmers can't get rid of.
Question for you. What do you have too much of right now? I know, weird question.
So we buy a lonesome porterhouse steak, and I nearly keel over when I pay $26, and quark. Not the subatomic particle, but an often discarded dairy product.
Quark is kind of like a German cream cheese. Basically, it has the texture of ricotta, and since their cows feed off grass, it has a little bit of grassiness to it, which is beautiful.
Plus pea shoots, carrots, onions, watermelon radish, and Celerac.
Okay, so that's relatively little. That's funny. Just a couple carrots and some radish. Okay.
And then Keith brings up something I am always willing to buy.
Coffee.
I could use a coffee.
My response is Pavlovian. Keith envisions using it for flavoring the carrots, a plate of coffee, cream, and sugar made of vegetables.
Sweetness of the coffee, that acts as your sugar. The earthiness and deepness of the coffee is going to come through in the carrot because it's porous. And then quark for the cream. We got a dish.
What do you want for coffee?
We pick up some locally roasted coffee for $11. That's the smallest bag they sell it for. Altogether, we're in for $61. And we decide that next time, we'll aim for a much tighter budget.
Want me to hold your coffee for you, dear?
Yes, sir.
I can do it for you.
You are an all-purpose guy.
You know.
The next day, we meet at a friend of Keith's roomy kitchen in Nashua. Pots are simmering on the stove, and he's prepped a neat row of ingredients in small bowls.
Okay, so what have we got here?
Over here, those wonderful watermelon radishes that we got.
Keith builds up a little teepee of coffee-infused carrots above the layer of soft cheese. He adorns it with pickled watermelon radish and cumin-toasted breadcrumbs and one artfully layered pea tendril.
It's good.
It is freaking delicious.
Good.
I don't know if I can say that on the radio.
Altogether, it is yummy and more inventive than I would have thought of, but it is simple. Keith says that's the trick. With food this good, you just have to work not to mess it up.
Okay, loving the first course.
Second course.
The fanciest thing? He's sous-viding the porterhouse steak. That is a thing. Sous vide is French for under vacuum, basically sealing food and seasonings in a vacuum pack and immersing it in a slow, warm, gentle whirlpool bath.
Wow. The pea shoot tendrils are awesome.
And finally, Chef Keith sits down, not to eat, but to talk.
What you have in front of you is 100% local.
I am completely sold on the food and on Keith's devotion, which does not come off as even remotely pious. Keith grew up in Nashua and found his way to loving food by experimenting with his grandmother's cookbooks.
I think I got tired of eating box mac and cheese. God bless her, but she's not the best cook. And so for us, it was a necessity. She would work two jobs. I would come home from school.
20 years later, he's established himself as something of an evangelist for local food, and the relationships and community that it builds.
We want to be able to support local farms, but also introduce people to a new way of eating.
Still, stuck in my Yankee craw is paying $61 to make an everyday, meaning not dinner party, meal. The food is undeniably gorgeous and delicious, but fresh local food is a more expensive choice for many families. What does that mean for someone like Keith? Who's known what it's like to struggle?
There's no question that there's a cost that is much higher associated with buying local. But cost is subjective. Do we value the cost up front of the money that we're spending on local healthy products, keeping our money right here in this community? Because at the end of the day, we're voting with our dollar. When we go to a supermarket and we purchase a tomato, that tomato is typically picked 3,500 miles away by migrant workers. That tomato is picked when it is actually not ripe, ripened with ethylene gas over the course of this trip to that supermarket. When you buy that, you're buying a system. If you buy the tomato from the farmer, you're buying a system. It's all up to what we want to do.
I'm going to eat more.
Please do. You want anything to drink? Water?
Yes, water would be great. No ice. You know what? I just decided I'm not going to share this with my colleagues. I'm going to bring it home and eat dinner tonight.
In my defense, the portions were kind of delicate. You can see photographs of the mud season meal cooked by Keith Saracen, the chef and founder of The Farmer's Dinner. He is an intuitive chef, but he did write down the recipes, so you can try them at home. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is time for Overheard, our semi-regular segment on what we who work in radio are listening to. Molly Donahue is with me. She is a producer for the creative unit, and so is executive producer Maureen McMurray. So we're going to start with you, Molly. What have you got?
So today I have a clip from a podcast I've just recently, it was recommended to me by a friend, and I don't always take podcast recommendations, but this
because
one,
you have such a discerning ear.
Because I have such a discerning ear. But this one related to me in particular. It's called the Dead Pilots Society. So they take TV show pilots that were sold by like actual professional screenwriters and were never made, and they do table reads of them with like real actors. So this is the second episode of the Dead Pilots Society. It's from John Hodgman. He's a comedian. He has a podcast. He's just a generally funny person. And his pilot is called Only Child, which is why I listened to it first, because I am also an only child. And he very aptly describes us all worldwide as the Worldwide Super Smart Afraid of Conflict Narcissist Club, of which I am a card-carrying member, as is he. And so in this first clip, he is introducing the concept of the show, which is he lives in a boarding house with his parents.
And there was one section of the house that was essentially a self-contained apartment. And when one of the tenants moved out, and I was just in high school at that point, I said, I am going to move into that apartment. I had a perfectly big, beautiful room that I had never had to share in my life already, but I needed an apartment. Because I'm 14 years old, and I've earned it, you know? And it was all part of my ploy to skip the terror of sexual adolescence and just immediately become the sexless gentleman bachelor that I envisioned as my perfect self.
So that is him introducing the concept of this show, which I just, John Hodgman is my soul twin.
Yes,
in so many ways. And what they do with the table read is what he wanted to do with the original show when it was going to be produced by FX. They were going to have all of the teenagers played by real teenagers, but John Hodgman was going to play himself as a 14-year-old.
So wait, which year was this pitched?
Was pitched a couple years ago. This episode is from the end of 2016 when they were doing the table read. The show was supposed to take place in 1984. And so John Hodgman would be a 45-year-old man playing himself as a 14-year-old. And for the table read, they got other 14-year-olds to play the teenagers. And this is the opening of the show in the script.
Thank you. We are exterior on a tree-lined street in Brookline, Massachusetts, and close on an 11-year-old boy bicycling down the street.
Miles Horchow is 11. He's got a 7-year-old brother named Simon who's 5 inches taller than Miles and runs around his house naked all the time.
We widen to reveal another 11-year-old boy bicycling.
Edmund Park just turned 12. He has a twin sister and an older brother. They all do archery, and they all sleep in the same bed.
We widen to reveal a third 11-year-old boy, John Hodgman. But this child is played by a grown man, also bicycling.
I'm John, and I'm an only child. A lot of people think only children are weird and lonely, but they're out of their minds. I have my own room, my own life. I'm basically a grown man.
And this pilot didn't sell?
It sold. It just never got made.
Oh.
So the whole podcast is just like this group of really funny, they're all comedy scripts. I haven't listened to many other episodes, but this one is my favorite.
It was made for you, Molly.
It was made for me. It really was. I just relate so much to 14-year-old John Hodgman.
And what was the name of the podcast again?
The Dead Pilot Society.
I'm going to listen.
Hmm.
Okay, Dead Pilot Society from Molly Donahue. What have you got, Maureen, for us today?
So mine, in the spirit of baseball season, is a historical clip because this month marks the 70th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. In this clip, Jackie Robinson is speaking to a reporter from Focus magazine, and he's recounting an experience he had in 1948, which was his second year in the majors playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And he's recounting an experience there. And when he says Pee-wee, he is referring to his teammate.
Pee-wee left his position and walked over to mine while they were doing the writing. And he put his hand on my shoulder as if to say to them, go ahead and yell and say what you please. The only thing that matters as far as Pee-wee Reese is concerned is that Jackie Robinson plays as well as he possibly can for the Brooklyn Baseball Club and that he conducts himself in a manner that makes him worthy of being a member of the team. Another instance was the time that the Philadelphia Phillies came into Brooklyn, and they were quite vicious with their remarks, and they are all directed at me. But the fellows on the ball club resented this more than I think people realized. And the fact that the Phillies continued to ride me, I think brought our ball club much closer together.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, and he says it with such equanimity, he's taken it in stride in some kind of way.
Just sort of like okay with it, or not okay with it, but just accepting that that was a fact of what had happened.
It's actually interesting because the moment that he's talking about this embrace with his teammate Pee Wee Reese, there has been, not controversy or anything, but there's been some debate about where that happened. Jackie Robinson says that it happened in Boston in 1948. Other people claim that it happened in Cincinnati in his rookie season. But regardless of that, there's now a monument in front of Brooklyn Cyclone Stadium in Coney Island of that moment.
Wow, that's so great.
It's incredible. So it's been 70 years this month.
Okay, I have another historical piece. It is such a crazy piece of radio as far as I'm concerned. This is from March 21st, 1977, and it's the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company. The show is As It Happens. The host is Barbara Froom, and she was quite legendary, I guess, in the CBC. And basically, there was a man holding 11 hostages inside of a bank, and her producers got him on the phone. So she talked to him live while this is happening. Let's hear it.
I want to see 130, lady, and that's all. The rest is incidental.
Can we talk to any of the people you're holding there?
Yeah, okay. Hang on, I'll get somebody.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, who's speaking?
My name is Barbara Frum.
Yes?
Who are you?
My name's Lois.
How are you doing there, Lois?
Well, it could be better, I'd say.
How did this thing start?
Well, he just sort of...
So it's just extraordinary. So the hostage taker is Robert McLaughlin, and he apparently wants a C-130 plane to go to Uganda and see his friend, he says, Idi Amin, who he's never met before, but he wants to go there. I guess he admires him in some way. But as you guys will hear, I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, unbelievably Canadian.
She's like, is there anyone there I can speak with? I love that he's like, just a moment. Hello, hostage. Do you mind speaking? She's a radio host.
It's, I can't imagine what it was like to be listening to the radio in 1977 when, of course, there were a lot of these kind of, I'm hijacking a plane, or it was a tense time in many ways. But to hear it so politely executed, let's hear more.
Impeccable phone manners.
How are you being held there? He's let you come to the phone. Is everyone walking around loose?
Yes, well, not walking around. We're all in one room, and he sent me down to get everybody's lunches and water, so he's treating us very well.
Oh, that's nice.
And he said he didn't want to hurt anybody. All he wants is apparently some kind of aircraft.
He sounds very calm just now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, he is very calm. I just hope nobody gets him excited, because then, you never know what people will do. And since he's the only one with a gun and we're all up here, you know, I just hope everybody gives him what he wants.
Tell him we are on our other line. We're getting the police chief.
Okay. Did you want to speak to the police chief?
Good production.
Is he there? Is the police?
We're trying to raise him on the other line, you see.
Okay, because you said when he comes on the line, I guess he wants to talk to him, but in the meantime, he's just...
Wow.
Yes, so she gets Staff Superintendent Webster on the phone, and he talks to Lois, and then he gets turned over to Robert McLaughlin, and they talk in pretty much the same manner.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, it's Staff Superintendent Webster speaking.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and you are?
My name's Lois.
Lois?
Lefebvre.
Lois Lefebvre.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And does this chap want to speak to a police officer?
Yes, he does.
All right, I'll speak to him.
Okay, just hold.
Thank you.
He's on the line.
Hello.
Hello, it's Staff Superintendent Webster, Metro Police speaking.
Uh-huh.
Is that, who is this?
That's Bob McLaughlin.
Bob?
Yeah, that's right. I'm the fellow with the gun.
Yes, all right. What can I do for you now?
Nice telegraphing there, Robert.
We want to keep the situation calm and cool.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Without any tricks, and I can assure you of that. But I think that you should release some of those people there who will be, may have illnesses that we're not aware of. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'll check out any of them that might have illnesses, and if they all seem to be all right, I think we'll just keep things the way they are for now. I'll maybe release them a bit later, you know.
Wow. And this was all on the radio?
It was live on the radio. It was live on the radio. Just unbelievable. And apparently it ended peacefully. Nobody was hurt. He gave himself over. But he does talk to the police chief about, like, you know, the chief says, well, how are you going to get from the here to there to the airport? And he says, well, you can send one of your tactical vehicles. I mean, this guy clearly has not thought this through.
No. But just that moment, Lois calls to him, do you want to talk to the police chief?
Do you want to? Did you get our lunches?
It's not dog day afternoon.
Not at all. So, Virginia, if someone called into the station, a hostage situation, do you think you could talk them down as well?
It's interesting that she's not really talking him down. She's being such a reporter. Like, she says to him, how many guns do you have? But one of the interesting things here is that, you know, this was before Twitter. Like, can you imagine somebody telling, you've got to listen to the CBC now? How many people were listening by the end of this episode? It's kind of stunning to think about.
That's what they call how you get the ratings.
Now, is there anything further that you wish to tell me at this time?
No, I think that's all.
All right, Bob, let me give you our phone number here, too. We'll keep a line open for you all day. 929-3272.
3272. All right, okay. See you later.
Well, that is a clip from the CBC Radio's Barbara Frum, legendary broadcaster, doing a legendary job. You can find links to all of our overheard clips at wordofmouthradio.org. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Maureen, thanks for bringing in a little bit of Jackie Robinson.
And thank you, Virginia.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Broke for Free, Blue Dot Sessions, Kumiku, and Tyler Gibbons. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play for our podcast and listen on your own schedule. And if you like it, please rate it. Just an FYI, I'm going to be at the Music Hall this Sunday afternoon interviewing Anthony Doerr, winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for his hauntingly beautiful World War II novel, All the Light We Cannot See. Anthony's going to be starting the show with a presentation about the process of writing the novel. So fans of the book and of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop really ought to make their way there. I'm Virginia Prescott. Don't forget, good news travels by word of mouth. This is a production of NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.